It's time for Let's Talk Money.
Good afternoon, Chattanooga. You're listening to Let's Talk Money with Jim Place and Jamie O'Donnell. 267-1023 is our number. We start our market day. Dow Jones average sits at 38,605 points, up 16. S&P at 5,440.42, up 11. Jamie, how are you?
I'm great.
Doing well for a Monday?
Yep. Had a great weekend. No complaints.
Well, good. Jim, how about yourself?
Doing well for a Monday. I don't know about you, but it's getting warm on our side of town. What's it look like in East Brainerd?
I would say it's about the same.
Yep.
Yeah.
Warm.
Wow.
Maybe hot.
There's something to be said for the lake or air conditioning, one or the other.
Mm-hmm.
Or both, preferably. But it won't be long until summer starts.
All right, so here we go. From the law firm Shambliss and Bonner. Shambliss, Bonner, Stoffel. What do they call it now, Justin?
Well, you know...
I just say Shambliss, tell you the truth.
You know, we're Shambliss Law. Colloquially, Shambliss, Bonner. Officially, Shambliss, Bonner, and Stoffel. We'll pretty much answer to anything if you call us.
All right, so Justin Farrow with us this afternoon, and Kathleen Cecliano.
Yes, that's correct.
I did it
well
good.
Well done.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Off to a good start here.
All right. Justin, let's start with you.
Got it.
We've got a couple of rules, a couple of areas that we want to focus on today. The first being two different aspects. One is DOL regulations around overtime and the FTC action on non-competes and non-solicitation agreements. If you're a business owner, this impacts you.
Big time.
Let's begin with... overtime rules.
So that's really Kathleen's expertise. She's done into those dug into those regulations a lot. But I'll tell you, Jim, compensation's going up, or you're going to get a lot more overtime.
What's going on with it, Kathleen?
Yeah, that's right. So for those listening that might not be completely familiar, the Fair Labor Standard Act applies to employees and employers who, unless specifically exempted, those employees must receive overtime pay for all hours worked in excess of 40 hours in one work week. So some of those exemptions that we might be familiar with are the most common ones, and we'll refer to the EAP or the white-collar exemptions. That includes people who work in the executive, administrative, or professional role that might qualify for an exemption from overtime pay for those 40 hours or more per week.
Now, it used to be that would be a distinguishable difference between somebody that was hourly and somebody that was salaried.
That's right. So that's a good question, because even if you're a salaried employee, you could still be subject to those overtime requirements if you're working more than 40 hours a week, if you're not an exempt employee under the FLSA.
I mean, in the business world, they used to make people salaried so they could work them 60 hours.
Right, right. And we get that question quite a bit. Well, I have an employee as salary, so therefore I don't have to pay them overtime. And it's not that easy, unfortunately. We still have to go through that analysis to figure out if they're an exempt employee under the EAP or not.
What would make an employee exempt?
So there are a few different tests that we have to look at. But one of them, baseline, is someone has to be paid a salary. That is the first test that we look at, and that's across the board. And that salary is going up from what's currently $684 per week to $844 per week starting on July 1. So that's what we want employers and company owners to take from this. Number one is that July 1st is the big change date, and we have to start looking at an increase in pay on a weekly basis. But after that, if we go through the executive exemption, that might be someone whose primary duties are managing the enterprise or managing a customarily recognized department or subdivision, and they also have to customarily and regularly direct the work of at least two or more full-time employees and have the authority to hire and fire people on a regular basis.
Does the average employer know this?
Employers, they should know this, yes. They should know that they're having employees that are classified as exempt or non-exempt. But the question that we get quite often is, what exemption are they? Are they an executive, an administrator, or a professional?
Well, if I don't have a time clock, how do I know? I mean, if you were working on a project and chose to stay late for 3 or 4 days in a row, I mean...
Who's tracking it? Or who's supposed to be tracking it?
Let me give you an example. in the NCAA in college football, you are allowed to practice. Total involvement with the program can only be for X amount of hours per week. So I asked the head coach at UTC who tracks that. He said, I do.
So
now, at big time programs, somebody does. You have to hire somebody that times everything.
Hopefully, employers are offering employees jobs that are either classified as exempt or non-exempt. So before someone starts working, we know if we need to be tracking their hours or not. Now, Justin might have something to add on to this on who who's responsible for actually tracking that.
Well, yeah, I think the law puts the onus on the employer to track the time worked, right? But I think your first question, Jim, was a great one, is how do I know if I'm exempt or non-exempt? And I think most employers don't. Most employers think if I pay somebody a salary, they don't get overtime. And
that's what I would have thought, tell you the truth.
That's right. And that's just one part of the test. You have to pay them a salary, and they also have to meet the duties test. So where we typically will get into a situation where an employer is going to be held liable is, you know, they've paid somebody a salary, they've paid their front desk clerk or their janitor a salary, and those people have worked 60, 70 hours a week, and they say, well, I'm entitled to all this back overtime. And the company owner goes, well, I paid you a salary. You don't get overtime. Well, yeah, you do, because you didn't pass the duties test. And as you, as an employer, your obligation is to track those hours worked. And if you don't, to your point, Jim, then we're going to have to rely on the employee's reasonable estimate. And I can tell you from experience, those employees always are very hardworking and have worked a lot of overtime when you don't have those records.
Yeah, so it's going to be incumbent upon the employer to keep the records.
That's right.
I mean, it's different. I mean, it's different. It'd be easy if somebody's punching a time clock.
That's right.
I mean, it kind of speaks for itself.
And that's what's typically required of most hourly workers, right? We call them hourly and salary. In the law, it's non-exempt and exempt. So if you're paid on an hourly basis, you're going to be a non-exempt employee, and you're going to punch a clock, and you're going to be entitled to time and a half when you work over 40, as Kathleen said. When you get into some of the more nuanced aspects of employment law, of paying those non-exempt employees a salary, reverse engineering their regular rate to pay their overtime, or really looking at their job duties to see if we can fit them into one of those EAP exemptions, if they supervise people, if they work in kind of the business operations, or if they qualify as a professional, as those terms are defined in the regs.
Kathleen, let me back off this subject just a hair and talk a little bit about how employers potentially game the system. Healthcare would be an example, I would think. I mean, most of the time, I'm familiar with employers that in order for you to be on the healthcare plan, you got to be considered full-time. And I think the number I've heard is like 32 hours makes a person full-time. How many companies out there hire people and don't allow them to work more than 28 hours?
It actually does happen quite often because a lot of employers are trying to stay away from having to pay that healthcare benefit. So if we're hiring someone, we want to make sure that it's clear from the beginning that it's going to be a part-time position so that we avoid overtime pay and we avoid having to pay the health insurance, because health insurance will kick in on an average once someone starts working average 32 hours per week.
So in essence, you've got to be pretty clear on that. And there's some type of employment agreement that people are signing. I would make the assumption if they were going to be permanent part-time, it's going to be disclosed that they're not going to be working more than X hours.
Usually during the job posting or a job offer, an offer letter is what we're looking at most of the time. But employers and employees are not required to sign employment agreements that contract them to work for any extended period of time. But usually, yes, the offer letter is what's the most important part.
What should be included in any type of employment agreement?
Well, Jim, I think, you know, like Kathleen said, I think the first thing you're going to do is back up and see, do you really want an employment agreement? You know, a hallmark of employment law in Tennessee is the at-will employment doctrine, and that means that people are free to leave employment or have their employment terminated at any time for any reason, with or without cause or notice.
Right to work state is what they...
Well, that's what a lot of people call it. That's not technically right, right? Right to work means right to work without being forced to join a union. Right. What we're really talking about is the at-will employment doctrine. So the employment relationship is at the will of both parties, and any time either party wants to end it, they can. If you start getting into that contractual relationship, then you're obligating yourself to maybe a definite duration of employment or to provide a certain level of benefits, and you lose that flexibility that you normally have as an employer in an at-will employment state to be able to modify on a going forward basis, you know, the terms and conditions of employment, whether that be compensation, whether that be benefits or perks offered, or whether that be, you know, actually severing the employment relationship itself.
Where would you want one?
I think you would want one, you know, and I think you'd want one in a situation where you want to be very clear and defined on the benefit roles. I think you want one with an executive. I think you want one when you are going to define when you can terminate immediately and when the executive or other employee has to give notice. You want to obligate them to provide them an advance notice so they can't just walk out the door, you know, the day they terminate. I think you also want one when you want to include those restrictive covenants in there, whether that be a non-disclosure or a non-compete if the FTC will allow them, or a non-solicitation agreement. Those are typically the situations where you want that, what I'll call the informal documentation of the employment relationship and the offer letter, where you want it more fully formalized in a written employment agreement signed by both parties.
267-1023. Let's talk money. We'll be right back.
Let's talk money on Talk Radio 102.3.
You're back with Let's Talk Money, 267-1023. I have a question for both of you right here. Your guess, how many people in this country work as an independent contractor that should be classified as employees?
I would say of the people that are classified as independent contractors, probably greater than 70%.
Yeah.
Are really, truly employees. Can you distinguish the difference between, what's the real rule for that? Because I know it gets abused.
Yeah, it's a loaded question, Jim, because the rule for independent contractor status is going to depend on which body of law you're traveling under. Are you looking at tax law for the Internal Revenue Code?
Oh, that's a good point.
Are you looking at state payroll tax law? Are you looking at a discrimination law? Because they all have different factors. I'll tell you kind of the basic test is right to control the manner and means by which the person performs the work. So I give a great example of a deck builder, right? If I tell somebody I want a deck built on the back of my house and I want it to be 20 by 20 and I want it to be done by July 1st and it needs to be built out of treated lumber and I'll pay them $2,000 and they show up when they want, they work when they work as long as they want, they supply the nails, they supply the saws, they supply the hammers, they're more like an independent contractor. Right?
Okay.
But if I tell
a true independent contractor,
but if I tell that same person, hey, I'm going to hire you to build my deck, and you're going to work from 8 to 5 every day, and we're going to use my hammer and my nails and my saw, and this is how we're going to build it, and we're going to start at the east corner and move to the west corner, and we're going to construct it this way, and I'm going to pay you $12 an hour for your hour's work, then that looks more like an employee.
Okay, that's a really good example of it.
Only kind I give, Jamie.
I like it.
I would venture to say, a lot of people have pushed that envelope. A lot of employers have pushed that envelope through the years.
I think a lot of them do. And I mean, it's really, you know, you could argue that some people want to do it for nefarious motives, but I think most of the time it works out for the contractor and for the employer. It's not a mechanism to try to avoid benefits or avoid employment protections or anything like that, like employers are demonized for doing. I think it's just a lack of understanding of the rules, and typically, the contractor wants it that way, too, because they get an advantage from being classified as a contractor and getting to do multiple jobs and come and go as they please. And so I don't think it's any ill motive. I think it's just kind of a function of, you know, everybody doing what they think is best for them. And it's not necessarily done with an eye toward what the legal standard actually is.
If we go back to the overtime rules, guys, Justin, would you explain it maybe the way you did to me during the break, which helped me kind of wrap my head around it?
Yeah, so an overtime exemption, meaning you are exempt from the overtime requirements of the FLSA, is a two-part test. Part one is that you're paid on a salary basis, and that salary has to meet or exceed the threshold that's set by the FLSA, and those are the thresholds that are going up, as Kathleen mentioned, on July 1 and then again on January 1. So they're significantly increasing that salary threshold. But that's only one part of a two-part test.
Okay.
The second part is, do you meet the duties element of whatever test you're trying to apply for? So paraphrase simply, if you're trying to apply for the executive exemption, do you supervise two or more people and have authority to hire and fire? If it's the administrative exemption, are you focused on kind of the running of the business and not the business's output? So think your accounting staff, your HR staff, your marketing staff. Are you doing office or non-manual work and able to exercise discretion and independent judgment in what you do? If you are trying for the professional exemption, do you have or work in a position that requires a 4-year advanced degree or specialized knowledge or instruction that's similar to a 4-year advanced degree. Even if you meet the salary threshold but don't meet the duties threshold, then you're not properly classified as exempt. And conversely, even if you meet the duties threshold, if you supervise the entire company but you don't meet the salary basis test, then you're not properly classified as exempt.
All right, let me ask, and I don't know which one of you guys wants to address this. If I've got a salaried employee that is not properly exempt and they work overtime, how do I calculate the overtime? Because I understand how overtime works when you have an hourly paid individual. How does it work when you're paying them a salary?
Well, hearing the pause, I'll take it as that's my question. So it's really going to be two ways, Jamie. If you haven't agreed otherwise on the front end, then what you're typically going to do is you're going to take that salary, divide it by 40. That will give you the regular rate, and then multiply that by 1.5 and pay that for every hour over 40.
Okay.
Now, there is a way. It's kind of the fluctuating work week method for somebody whose hours vary each week. You can agree with them on the front end that their salary of let's call it $1,000, right?
Yep.
We're going to pay you $1,000. That compensates you for all hours worked at the regular rate. So if you work overtime, you'll only get the halftime rate. And my mathematicians on air will realize that if I work 40 hours, that $1,000 is a $25 regular rate. If I work 50 hours, that $1,000 is a $20 regular rate. If I work 60, it's something less than 20,
okay,
like 1667. So your regular rate goes down in proportion as your hours go up, meaning that your halftime, the what you get paid for the overtime,
yep,
your halftime shrinks the more you work.
Okay, that makes sense.
Pregnancy, couple of changes.
A few. You know, the Pregnant Workers Fairness Act passed in Tennessee a couple of years ago and passed federally, I want to say last year, year and a half. And essentially what it says is you have to provide pregnant employees with an accommodation for a pregnancy-related condition. That's pretty easy. I think the law, which came as part of the National Defense Authorization Act, was about 5 lines long. The EEOC has now issued, pursuant to its statutory authority to implement the law, about 400 pages worth of regulations as to what it means to be required to accommodate a pregnant employee, what sort of accommodations look like, what pregnancy means, because it's not just pregnancy, it's pregnancy, childbirth, or related medical conditions. And so it is a very well-intentioned expansion of the rights of pregnant employees in the workplace, because fundamentally, you know, you didn't have any obligation to accommodate a pregnant employee's limitations in their ability to perform their essential job functions, right? If they had a significant medical condition, it might fall under the ADA, Americans with Disabilities Act, which has a reasonable accommodation component. If they needed leave and had been there, you know, long enough, they could get leave under the FMLA. But just the terms of, if you think a pregnant employee with a lifting restriction or needing more frequent bathroom breaks, or the ability to take water to their work station, there was nothing that required those types of accommodations until you got the Pregnant Workers Fairness Act federally and then the implementing regulations from the EEOC. Those take effect this week.
Seems reasonable.
It's reasonable, Jamie, and I think the more protections we can provide for pregnant individuals in the workplace, the better. These regulations are pretty expansive, and I think they fail to take into account the vagaries of every different workplace. And I mean, for example, there are a few accommodations they put in there, like taking water to your workstation or more frequent breaks, that they call predictable assessments that should require no analysis and should essentially be automatically given. And not every workplace is the same. So like our office environment, it's going to be easy to do that.
Sure.
But a manufacturing workplace is going to be very difficult to, particularly if you think about, you know, chemical or food manufacturers that have quality control standards, you can't necessarily have snacks and food on the line in a manufacturing facility.
Yep.
So it's a little bit harder to implement, however well-intentioned it is.
Yeah. That tends to be how they make laws. They try, and they don't always get it right.
That's why Kathleen and I still are employed.
That's right.
All right, let's move on to non-competes. Solicitation agreements. This entire ball game is changing.
Yeah, so there's been a push at the state level across the country over the last decade and a half to outlaw non-competes. And I think we need to frame this discussion by what do we mean by non-compete? That is your typical employee leaves employment and is prohibited from working in a defined geography for a defined period. So you can think your typical, you can't work within a 50-mile radius of your employer for the 2-year period after your employment ends. That's a non-compete. And that reached national level a few years ago, and the Federal Trade Commission has enacted a final rule that, if allowed to take effect, would take effect September 4th, incidentally, the day after my birthday. But that would ban all non-competes. So it would ban new non-competes. You can't have one with anyone going forward with a small sale of business exception. You can't enforce any existing non-compete unless it's with a senior level executive. And that term is defined pretty narrowly. So it essentially, at the federal national level, outlaws non-compete and outlaws mostly existing non-compete enforcement if it's allowed to go into effect.
What's interesting is it's also retroactive, isn't it? I mean, it eliminates, normally you'd say, they'd pass a law and say after September the 4th, it's X.
So it's interesting, right? It's not necessarily retroactive. They tried to control against that. And the way they controlled against it, so the FTC has the right to regulate unfair business practices or methods. And so what they've defined in this context as an unfair business practice or method is the enforcement of a non-compete after the effective date, right? So it's not going back and retroactively wiping out and requiring the rescission of that underlying agreement, which they were kind of attempting to do with the rules that were proposed. What instead they've done is they've called it an unfair business practice to enforce an existing non-compete or to enter into a new one. That was their way around retroactivity.
How are companies going to address this to the extent that they really feel like they're being put at a competitive disadvantage?
Well, the first thing we always ask our clients is, what are you worried about? Do you care if John goes and opens up a competing shop down the road or goes and works for a competitor? And I'll say, typically the answer is no. Typically what companies care about is protecting their client relationships, protecting their employee relationships, and protecting their confidential information. So what companies are going to have to take a really close look at now is how robust the protections are in their existing agreements around non-solicitation, non-disclosure, non-soliciting employees. They're going to have to tighten up those agreements. Again, if the rule is allowed to go into effect, and it's been the Federal Trade Commission has been sued across the country. There's a leading case in Texas that the U.S. Chamber of Commerce has joined. We anticipate that there might be a ruling on the initial request to stay the effectiveness of these rules, you know, maybe within the next 2 or 3 weeks. So I caveat all this by saying we need to prepare as though it's going to go into effect, but it may not end up going into effect. And we saw that with the OSHA emergency temporary standard around the COVID vaccines that I think I was on last time and talked about. But I think you need to look at your existing agreements, and you're going to have to roll out a model notice as well. If this is allowed to go into effect, notifying you know, anybody that might reasonably under an existing non-compete that you want to enforce it.
267-1023, Let's Talk Money. We'll be right back.
Let's Talk Money. Talk Radio 102.3.
You're back with Let's Talk Money. 267-1023 is the number. All right. How does corporate America move forward with basically the banning of non-competes? Give me the steps that I need to take as a business owner to ensure what it is I'm trying to ensure, and it may very well be what I'm trying to ensure no longer exists.
So I think first step is figure out what you're trying to protect, right?
That's what you ask clients.
What
are you concerned about?
What do you care about? And assuming it is customers and employees and information, then we're going to make sure we have robust protections in a non-solicitation agreement and non-disclosure agreement. And I want to be clear, non-competes have been banned, if it goes into effect, by the FTC's rule. Non-solicits, non-disclosure agreements, other similar agreements remain valid unless they're drafted so broadly enough to fall into the non-compete definition as the FTC has defined it. So you can't just scratch out non-compete and write non-solicit in crayon on top of your agreement and say, see, we're all good. They're actually going to look at what the scope of the provision is and what it operates to bar. But if it realistically operates, you know, soliciting or taking business away from the company, taking employees away from the company, frittering away your confidential information and using it or disclosing it in a new venture. Those should remain valid under the FTC rule.
Talk about what is a non-solicitation agreement.
Non-solicitation agreement normally prohibits soliciting, accepting business from, or working with, and a variety of other verbs. Depends on how long you want to draft that list of things you can't do. But it protects that client relationship. So if I, as a company, have made you, Jamie, the face of my company for a set of customers or all my customers, I want to protect that customer relationship because you've been able to develop it under my wing and while you're being paid by me. So when you leave, I don't want you calling on those customers and I don't want you working with those customers. I want to keep you away from those customers for a defined period. Same with my current employees. I don't want you to leave and raid my shop and take all my good people with me.
Yep.
And then with respect to that business sensitive, proprietary, confidential information that you've been subject to as my employee, I want to make sure that you don't use it on your own benefit, for your own benefit, and don't disclose it to others so that they could use for their benefit. Those are the three main things we could put in an agreement.
Okay.
All right. If we were going down that road, and let's say I'm working for XYZ company and I am the head of their chemistry lab and we are developing XYZ and I am the lead component on the development of what it's going to be out there. How does the company that's put all the money into the R&D protect themselves?
Well, what the FTC says is you're going to have a really robust non-disclosure agreement, and you're going to have to rely on trade secret laws. You know, there are federal and state trade secret laws that exist right now that would ban the misappropriation of trade secrets and then have significant penalties carried with it, right? So, I mean, I think I would hate to call the federal agency naive, but I think the FTC is maybe a bit naive thinking, oh, everything will be covered by trade secret law and existing agreements. I don't think it's going to be that simple because once your information is out there, once your trade secret's misappropriated, once your client has been solicited or your employee, it's hard to unring that bell. So you might be able to get an injunction to stop it from happening again. Maybe you can get monetary damages, but it's going to be hard to unring certain bells. And I think that's where some business owners are looking to the non-compete as being an effective tool to keep you out of an industry for a defined period. And they don't have to worry about monitoring you as difficult as that may be and what you're doing with respect to your solicitation activities or with respect to your, you know, use of confidential information. Because I will tell you from experience that more often than not, we only know about non-solicitation violations when somebody whoopsies and sends an email to the old business address. And that's how we find out about it. Otherwise, we might be looking at a drop in customer business volume, but we don't necessarily know that it's tied to Jamie's departure until somebody inadvertently emails Jamie at my company instead of Jamie at new company. And that's how we find out Jamie's been working with them after the fact.
And the damage is kind of done at that point.
The damage is done because then when you end up in litigation with Jamie over this customer relationship, they've obviously gone with Jamie for a reason. They like Jamie. They've had a personal relationship with Jamie. And so the worst thing you can do as a company is draw your customer into this litigation because they'll typically say, look, I'm staying with Jamie. I wanted to go with Jamie and it's my choice. And if I can't stay with Jamie, I'm certainly not coming back with you.
I'll go somewhere else. Yep.
Now, when I hear the term non-disclosure, I've always thought of non-disclosures being around, I'm getting ready to sell my business. The potential buyer for my business is my competition, my local competition. I'm going to show you all of my books, all of my revenue, everything from A to Z. Historically, everybody involved with that process is signing a non-disclosure agreement in case the deal doesn't work. You can't use the information you acquired against them. Is that fair to say?
I would say that's one version of a non-disclosure agreement. But I think more typically the version that we're talking about is, well, I'm going to hire you and I'm going to let you into my company and I'm going to let you see how I do things. And the way that I do things and the information that I've developed has allowed me to be successful. And I don't want you to come in and learn the ropes from me, whether it's learn my pricing mechanisms, my profit margins, my, you know, if it's a manufacturing business, my manufacturing processes, my formulas, whatever sensitive information, client lists. I don't want you to learn all of that and decide, you know what?
I can do this.
I can do that a lot better than Justin can do it. So I'm going to go out and I'm just going to take the playbook that Justin developed and I'm going to use it on my own and essentially cut out Justin as the middleman.
So that done properly, I mean, it sounds as if in most cases, a non-compete wouldn't necessarily be needed? I guess what I'm saying is, where do you fall down on this from the standpoint? Do you agree with it, not agree with it? Do you think people need stronger non-disclosure and trade secret agreements than probably have all along?
I think I can agree with it in certain contexts. I don't think that non-competes necessarily should be outright banned. I think they probably serve a purpose in some situations. If you take, you know, the rule under Tennessee law is they have to be supported by an interest that's worthy of protection. And those are basically, you know, the provision of unique or specialized training, customer relationships, and confidential information. Well, we've talked about customer relationships and confidential information. But if I've trained you up on how to do this job, you know, far be it for me to say, okay, I've trained you, I've taught you how to be the best process mechanic, the best, you know, aviation mechanic, whatever it is. I've taught you all these skills. You've gone through my internal training academy. I've made you who you are. Now, if I'm Aerobus, why would I want you working for Boeing? Why would I want you taking all of that knowledge I poured into you and put it to use for my competitor, even if you're keeping it in your head? And you're not telling anybody my secrets, and you're not soliciting my customers or my vendors or my employees, but I've invested a lot of money in you and a lot of time, effort, and energy in training you up, and you shouldn't be able to put that training to use for someone else. So I think there's a place for them. I don't think there's a place for them everywhere or in every industry, but I think there's probably a place for them.
I guess there's a debate or an argument about the fact that if I go to work anywhere, I'm expecting over a period of time to increase my value or my personal intellectual property, and how much of that is Justin responsible for, and how much of that is Jim responsible for by being a diligent show up person that cross the T's and dot the I's. In the process of 5 or 10 or 15 years, I made myself better.
That's right. And I think that's why I think it's hard to just do a wholesale ban or a wholesale enforcement, right? Because I think there are situations where Jim made himself who he is because he's an industrious, hardworking, quick learner. I think there's some situations where Jim became the person he is because he went through the Justin Training Academy and learned the tools of the trade and learned how to be, you know, he came in as an apprentice and came out a skilled journeyman. You know, I think there are all those things. And so to have a one size fits all solution can be a bit tough.
267-1023. Let's talk money. We'll be right back.
Let's Talk Money. Talk Radio 102.3.
You're back. Well, Let's Talk Money. 267-1023 is the number. Kathleen, I want to come back to you and go back to our original conversation on overtime. And Justin, I think, appropriately said there are two sets of standards here. Go back to the salary standard, though.
Okay.
And talk about what's really changed there.
So the big change, I think, as Justin pointed out, is there's two elements that we have to look at for exempt or non-exempt employees. And when I say that, I mean those who are eligible for overtime and those who are not. And that's the salary basis test and then the duties basis test. So duties, those are not changing. What's changing and what's most important for employers to know right now is that the salary basis element is increasing. So right now, if you have an employee who is making $684 per week, which annualizes to about $35,568 per year, and they meet the duties basis test as well, then they may be classified as exempt, and they may not be eligible for overtime. Now, that number is significantly increasing. That number is going up to $844 per week on July 1, and that annualizes to $43,088 per year. And then again on January 1st, 2025, we're looking at another increase to $1,128 per week, which annualizes to $58,656
per year. So we're really talking about that test going from $35,000 a year to $58,000 a year.
That's right.
And that's a huge increase.
Yep. That's a huge increase for employers to recognize that, and they have to be able to make the decision, run the numbers on if it makes sense to give their employees an increase from roughly $35,000 to $58,000 per year to continue making them exempt and not receive overtime pay, or keep them at that base where they currently are and start paying them overtime.
Which really means if you have any employees that fall in those categories, you got to do the math.
That's right. Now is the perfect time to start running an audit internally on your employees, especially those employees who are making between 35 and 43 right now, and then figure out if we're going to increase them to 58 come January 1st.
Or are we?
Or keep them where they are and start tracking their hours and figure out if they need to be making an hourly wage and they may be eligible for overtime.
That's just a significant change. How many? Do you have an estimate of how many employees will be impacted?
The FLSA regulations and the DOL says about 4 million people would be entitled to overtime.
May or may not impact them, depending on if they work overtime. Is that?
It may or may not. I mean, I think you got to do that math, as Kathleen said. You got to figure out which is going to be more costly, a $20,000 raise or paying overtime. And that's going to be dependent upon their normal work schedule. I think you're going to see people tightening down on overtime, tightening down on hours worked if these 4 million people are entitled to overtime. I mean, we had one entity that we talked to that indicated it was going to be about a $400,000 hit. And this is not a huge operation. It is not a multinational corporation. And it was going to be a significant event for their business.
How much has a tight labor market made this not that big a deal? I mean, as salaries have increased, I know the increase that we're talking about here is pretty substantial, but are you getting much talent at that environment with the market, the labor market, the way it is?
You know, I think that's a fair point, Jim, and I don't really know the data on it, but I'd say, you know, at 35, you're maybe not getting that talent with as hot as the labor market is, but somewhere between 35 and 55, I think you're probably getting
it. You're hitting it somewhere between there, probably.
Yeah, because I think $57,000, $58,000 is still a good wage, right?
Yes.
Particularly in Chattanooga.
Guys, we appreciate it.
Thank you guys so much.
Thank you very much. Michael Yaffe coming up. Yaffe Live from 1 to 3, 3 to 7 Sport Talk. You'll have a great day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.